Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. So much major news breaking over the last couple of hours. Here with us to help break it all down from Washington is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Hey there, Kimberly.
Hi, Tiziana.
Oh, Kimberly, what a day.
Yes.
We were planning on asking you about some of the big stories going on this week, but now we got to cover just the last couple of hours. There's so much. First, we had the acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, essentially admit that the White House did engage in a quid pro quo in withholding aid to Ukraine. And then immediately after that, Vice President Pence announced a 120-hour ceasefire between the U.S. and Turkey in Syria. Let's start with the ceasefire. What can you tell us about it?
Well, not much so far. There are still more unanswered questions than answers at this point. In broad strokes, we know that this is a five-day ceasefire. Turkey has agreed to stop its violent incursion into Syria. In exchange, the United States will lift the sanctions it imposed and not impose any more sanctions. Beyond that, we can extrapolate some things. This five-day time limit, it comes just as President Erdogan of Turkey is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Sochi. That's not a coincidence. It is thought that Russia, with the United States pulling out from the region, Russia can come in and sort of fill that space. And of course, this gives Russia a lot of things that it wants, right? It gives it a toehold in the Middle East. It helps them boost Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, all while the U.S. is completely out of this. And there are other questions that we still don't know exactly what this safe zone that's been established that's supposed to protect the Kurds and allow them to get to safety. We don't even know exactly where that is. So that will all have to be fleshed out in the days ahead.
Kimberly, you said the U.S., all while the U.S. is out of this. If we're out of it, how do we enforce a ceasefire?
That's a great question. Enforcement is something that we really didn't get a lot of answers from Vice President Mike Pence when he was speaking from Turkey. We don't even know who will be in charge of it. Would it be the United States? Would Turkey enforce itself? Would it be Bashar al-Assad or any of the various militia groups that are involved there? That's yet another very big unanswered question.
All right. Now, let's back up like an hour to Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's briefing today. He basically admitted that President Trump was, in fact, pursuing a quid pro quo arrangement with Ukraine, but saying that in this case it was the pursuit of the CrowdStrike server central to a conspiracy theory about Democrats in the 2016 elections. Here's Mulvaney today in an exchange with reporters, basically saying this is not an unusual approach.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy.
So, Kimberly, that was one of many things Mulvaney said. Do his comments change the narrative on the Ukraine story?
I mean, essentially, it does, and it doesn't help the White House at all. As you mentioned, it was essentially an admission that there was some sort of quid pro quo happening with all of this. Recall in the beginning, the president and the White House were saying that there was no quid pro quo. That was their big defense. Now we have Mulvaney saying not only was there this exchange, but he told the press corps, get over it, that politics.
Literally,
is,
I mean, he said that
yes,
phrase,
he
right?
said the phrase, get over it, and saying that politics are always involved in these sort of efforts trying to normalize this, but also admitting that this wasn't about a policy, U.S.-Ukrainian relations. This was about a request for Ukraine to get involved in political issues. The DNC server from 2016, we heard from the transcript, the partial transcript itself, that Donald Trump was talking about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. So this admission doesn't help the White House at all.
Kimberly, Mulvaney also, he talked about the location of the next G7 summit, and he announced that it's actually going to be here in the U.S. on a Trump-owned Gulf property. Can
yes.
you remind us the potential of conflicts of interest that that decision indicates?
Yes, there are a lot. So the United States is hosting the G7 next year, and Donald Trump has chosen his own resort, Doral, in Florida, to be the host for this. Now, of course, there's the Emoluments Clause that prohibits the acceptance of money or any other thing of value from foreign countries that could sort of benefit the president. There's also all kinds of ethical issues involved here. The president is not subject to something called the Hatch Act, but everyone else in the government, federal government, is. This would be illegal if anybody else tried to do it. So it's a big problem. I added as an aside from all these ethical issues, Mulvaney was saying that it was the best property that they could find. Keep in mind that in Florida in June, it's hurricane season.
Oh, good point. All right. So that's all just since noon. But over the last 4 days, there has been a huge range of congressional testimony on the impeachment inquiry, some pretty critical revelations. We don't have time for a deep dive, but can you give our listeners the most important headlines?
Yeah. So this week, there were various people, former and current White House and State Department officials who were testifying. And the one thing that they seemed to be in agreement about was that Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor, was acting as sort of a freelance U.S. diplomat. Keep in mind, he has no official federal role in the White House or State Department or anywhere else, in search of political dirt, or as he called it, corruption within Ukraine, but aimed primarily at Joe Biden and his son Hunter, and that he was acting at President Trump's direction. President Trump was directing State Department officials and White House officials to work through Giuliani on this issue. It was a lot of very, very problematic testimony for the White House, as they continue to say that they were not involved in any quid pro quo, and very problematic for Rudolph Giuliani, who is essentially being accused of doing illegal things.
And he doesn't have a security clearance like he would if he were had a more official role with the White House. Is that
precisely
true?
He has no security clearance, as he would have to have if he was working in the White House. No vetting by the Senate confirmation if he was working in the State Department. This is the reason why we have those things in place. He sort of has skirted around them.
All right. I'd like to change gears a little bit here. Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings passed away early this morning at the age of 68. Can you give us a sense of his legacy?
Yes. I mean, that news really hit Washington hard. He has had a long career fighting primarily for civil rights, things like affordable health care and drug prices. Lately, he's been known most as the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, one of the key committees in the impeachment probe. But he still continued to work on a lot of other things. For example, when Ayanna Pressley, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, was pressing for solutions and answers about the Trump administration's decision to stop deferred action for people who are here for medical treatment, Cummings immediately called hearings on it. One of those was supposed to be held today.
That is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, so glad to have you.
My pleasure.
Now, let's stick with the nation's capital. We're going to turn now to Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman Moulton, thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's good to be here.
So, Congressman, a lot of news today, but before we get to it, I want to ask you also about Representative Elijah Cummings. He passed away early this morning. He was 68. Did you know the representative well, and how are you thinking about his legacy today?
I did know him, though I didn't know him well. You didn't need to know him well to be impacted by his example, by his leadership, and for all of us, his legacy. He was a great man. Someone who was respected on both sides of the aisle. And that's a hard thing to say about the chairman of the Oversight Committee, because in many ways, there's no more controversial position in the House of Representatives. And yet the words of praise and love and adoration that have been coming from Republicans, even in the midst of this impeachment inquiry on the event of his death, are really inspiring.
That is encouraging. It is inspiring. I wish we could stay there, but we have a lot of hard news we have to turn to. I'm sure you've heard about the ceasefire agreement between the U.S. and Turkey and Syria. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. President Trump is once again claiming victory for just partially undoing a tragedy he has created. This decision to abandon our allies, to betray the Kurds that we've been working with for years to combat ISIS, and to just suddenly pull the rug out from our troops, from under our troops, this is an unmitigated disaster. It's been beneficial to Russia. It's been beneficial to Assad. And there are high-value detainees from ISIS who are now being set free and will continue to try to attack the United States.
Congressman,
so
you said...
it's been a disaster on every level, and now he's just trying to undo part of it.
You used the phrase once again. Does that mean this is a pattern you feel like you've seen from the president in the past?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, the same thing has happened in Iran. he pulled America out of the Iran nuclear deal, which has been nothing but bad. Iran has restarted their nuclear weapons program as a result. They've started attacking our allies in the Gulf and threatening our assets. And so then when he says, okay, well, we're going to be tough on Iran, well, the only reason he has to respond is because he's created another problem. The same can be said for North Korea. At one point, he supposedly saved us from war from North Korea, but the only reason we were on the brink of war is because of his bungling of that terrible national security problem. I think that you're going to start to see the fallout from this decision in Syria in other places around the globe in the coming weeks.
So you've used terms today like betrayal, unmitigated disaster. Vice President Pence said this afternoon that their goal in traveling to Turkey was end violence immediately. And here's President Trump maybe an hour ago.
A lot of people in Turkey were killed. So that's not fair. Nobody likes to mention that. This was a great thing for the Kurds. This was a great thing for Turkey. This is great for everybody. And frankly, the thing that I'm most happy about is that I took a lot of heat, but that we were able to do it so fast. I thought this would go on for longer.
Congressman, Turkey sees the Kurdish groups in Syria as connected with the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which has a long history of carrying out violent attacks in Turkey. The U.S. has designated the PKK a terrorist group. So what do you say to that?
So let's just go step by step. First of all, this is not good for the Kurds. You can't find a person anywhere in the world who thinks this is good for the Kurds. So don't think that the president is doing anything but lying about that. Well, let's talk about Turkey for a second. Turkey is now pushing into Syria to try to occupy a part of that war-torn country, in theory to create some buffer for their own country against perceived terrorist threats. You know, we'll have to see, but I'll tell you what, our military advisors around here don't think this is going to be successful at all.
When you say
they think that what...
No, go ahead.
They think that what Turkey is basically doing is getting themselves into their own endless war, so to speak, in Syria. And so although it's too early to say, I think the president is going to be wrong about this being good for Turkey as well.
That was actually what I was going to ask you, so thank you. It's also been reported that two F-15 jets carried out an airstrike against U.S. munitions storage, a bunker in Syria, because there hadn't been adequate preparations for the withdrawal. You have seasoned military experience. What do you make of that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I'm not familiar with this, with the details of this particular report, but it doesn't surprise me one bit because there was clearly no preparation. Our troops were totally taken by surprise when their own commander-in-chief essentially pulled the rug out from under them and their allies, their friends, their Kurdish partners on the ground. There was no preparation for this. This took them all by surprise. And as we've seen reports come out from some of these special forces soldiers on the ground who put their reputations on the line to work with our Kurdish partners, they were totally taken by surprise, were unprepared for this, and frankly are ashamed of the actions by our commander-in-chief.
Congressman, I know you're aware that Speaker Pelosi had a fairly dramatic meeting at the White House yesterday with the president. She told reporters that during that meeting, the president explained that we would be sending troops to Saudi Arabia because they're paying us for it. Here is Speaker Pelosi.
The president said, well, the reason I'm taking the troops out of Syria is because I promised in the campaign to bring the troops home. My question to him was, is Saudi Arabia home? Is Saudi Arabia home? Why are our troops going to Saudi Arabia if you promised to bring them home? He said, well, the Saudi Arabians are paying for it.
How does one process the idea that we're sending troops somewhere because the country there is paying for it?
Well, honestly, this is pretty simple. Donald Trump has no idea what it means to serve. This is someone who dodged the Vietnam War, allowed someone to go in his place. And it's not like he did it so that he could protest the war or bring an end to the war. He did it so he could just take his father's money and pursue his business interests. So he doesn't fundamentally understand what serving the country is all about. He thinks of our troops as pawns that he can use for political purposes, whether it's to put them down on the border where they don't belong or to put them in Saudi Arabia where we don't even have a mutual security agreement. That means we have no legal responsibility or, frankly, even legal authority to support Saudi Arabia in this. America was not attacked by Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was attacked. And if the president wants to send troops to Saudi Arabia, he should come to Congress first.
So I wonder if if someone is a soldier, they're on the ground, and they hear this, President Trump's comments, this conversation, is it demoralizing? Is it concerning? How would somebody who's in active duty react to this?
Well, I would never want to speak for all active duty troops, but I can certainly speak for how it would feel if I were on the ground when I was serving as an active duty Marine officer. It would be incredibly demoralizing. It'd be shameful. I would be ashamed to have this person as my commander in chief. And we want a leader that we can look to uphold our values, a leader who inspires us to do the best in very difficult situations we find ourselves in on the ground. And Trump is the exact opposite. I mean, he's a draft dodger. He's someone who's happy to send other kids, other people's kids to take care of problems that he doesn't want to deal with himself. Just make no mistake. I mean, this is going to come back to haunt us. George Washington, way back at the founding of our country, said that if you don't take care of this generation of troops, then you're going to have a real serious problem recruiting the next generation to come and fight for us. And there are an awful lot of troops on the ground right now who are feeling betrayed by this president.
Before we shift gears, and I do want to, you've previously pushed for new party leadership. I'd like to ask you if you've been satisfied with Speaker Pelosi's response to all of this, especially in the heat of the last week or so.
Oh, I think she's done great. And I'm someone who's a fair critic, and I'm not afraid to stick my neck out to say when we need change and fight for my beliefs and not be cowed into just doing what the rest of the party wants to do. But I'm also not afraid to praise people when they do well. And I think that Speaker Pelosi has been certainly much more effective than Trump in these negotiations. She's clearly carrying the upper hand.
Let's shift gears to the overarching topic of the impeachment inquiry. I want to start. Mick Mulvaney, acting chief of staff, had this exchange during a briefing this afternoon. Here he is explaining the president's rationale for withholding aid from Ukraine during his call with President Zelensky.
Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money. Now, there was a report.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
Withholding the funding.
Yeah.
So this was fairly recently. There's been just a ton of sort of immediate response from people. Let me ask you, what is your immediate response?
I mean, this is just corruption on a whole new level. And the problem is that what the administration and people like Mulvaney are trying to do, the president did the same thing when he asked China to go ahead and pursue its own investigation, is they're just trying to normalize what is really criminal behavior. And as this impeachment proceedings these inquiry goes forward, you know, we're getting more and more information that's coming out. But we already have enough today with just what was included in that first whistleblower report and the report of the conversation that the president had with the president of Ukraine. That is enough in and of itself. To pursue impeachment. And I think people can't forget that. So every detail that comes out is a little bit more incriminating. But in some ways, the bombshell is already out there. And what the administration is trying to do now is just say, oh, no, this is totally fine. This is a totally normal thing to do. And of course, that's just playing public relations with this.
You just said there's more than enough. And that makes me want to ask you, Speaker Pelosi has said that the House is not going to do a formal vote on the question of the impeachment inquiry itself. Any concerns that not doing that undermines the legitimacy of this whole process in the eyes of the American public?
No, not at all. We're following the Constitution, and the Republicans are trying to talk about process because they don't want to talk about the substance.
So then why not do the vote and get it out of the way?
Because that is not the constitutional procedure here.
But it's not the constitutional procedure either.
Look, if you think it's wise for us to just give in to every Republican talking point on Fox News when it's not what is prescribed under the Constitution, then sure, I mean, go ahead. But that's not wise. You know, our duty, as the great Elijah Cummings said as an example, is to rise above the party fray, to do what's right by the Constitution and pursue this inquiry in the proper, deliberative way that the founders set out. And that's what we're going to continue to do. And it doesn't matter what sort of complaints the Republicans manufacture on this. This is the way this shall proceed. And I think it's important to uphold that. In fact, I think that if we were to hold a vote, it would be basically acquiescing to this false requirement put forward by the Republicans that we have a vote, and that's just not the case.
That is U.S. Representative Seth Moulton. He represents Massachusetts' 6th District. Congressman Moulton, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Listeners, I just want to take a moment to let you know that next Tuesday, October 22nd, Radio Boston will be hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at-large candidates. It will be at WBUR City Space. We'll ask the candidates about the biggest issues facing the city of Boston: affordable housing, education, the opioid crisis. It's part of our coverage this political season, produced as a part of WBUR's longstanding partnership with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. The debate will air live right here on 90.9 WBUR at 2:30 next Tuesday, and we will stream it live. But we'd love for you to join us at WBUR City Space. For more information and to get free tickets, go to wbur.org/events. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.